Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Erin Newcomb joins me. We're going to talk about Node.js, server-side JavaScript. What would that be for? You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Erin Newcomb. Episode 237, recorded January 9, 2013. Node.js. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, MerlinAtStoneAge.com, bringing you each week, or as often as we can, the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the small projects, the projects you might not have ever heard of, the projects that may power most of the websites that you look at, like maybe even this one. We'll see if that's the case. I'm bringing you this show as often as I can, and each week I'm joined by a lovely co-host, but that probably would not go over very well. A co-host, Erin Newcomb, welcome back to the show.
Oh, come on, I'm lovely.
Well, okay, I don't think that usually applies to guys, but okay, that's me just being a little bit stumbly here. Happy New Year to everyone. We're in the new year already. We're starting our Q1 schedule for now. And this week we have a very interesting guest. It's Matt Ranney. Now, Matt Ranney is going to talk about Node.js, and I'd been announcing that he was going to be on the show last week. But at the very last minute, he said, no, got to cancel. So we had to cancel last week's show at the last minute. But luckily, he said, no, I could be on the following week. So I'm really looking forward to talking with him. I've been looking at Node.js since, I was actually doing the research in time for last week. And I've had like an extra week to actually look at this stuff. And from what I understand, it is a way to have server-side JavaScript in something that allows you to have multiple things all happening at once, in a sense. Like maybe serving up web pages or talking to a TCP connection or going out and talking to a database, fetching information, that sort of thing. So it's JavaScript-based. It looks pretty simple to use, but I bet the complexity is in the details of how you actually go about this. What have you seen so far on Node.js, Erin?
Well, I've heard a lot about it. I don't know much about it, but it seems like everybody I talk to these days is talking about Node.js or doing something with Node.js or planning to do something with Node.js. So I'm really kind of curious why that is. Why is it so popular all of a sudden? What is it about it that makes it – is it faster? Is it easier? Is it – I don't know. I just want to find out more about it because I hear about it all the time. In fact, if you look out on any of the job posting sites, you'll see a lot of them. One of the things that they are looking for is people that know Node.js. And it seems like it's relatively new. So it's amazing that companies are already starting to really look for a big time people that know Node.js. So I'm kind of curious to see why that is.
Okay, and just before we get started, I also want to say thank you to Nami Media for providing me the nice little office space here so I can do the show. And they've been my client now for about a month, and they've actually paid me a paycheck, which is nice. So I know that we're legit now. And I've been speeding up their website, so that's what I'm doing here. It's a lot of fun. Also, I'm sporting my new medium-sized shirt. I'm losing weight still, so I've had to downscale all my wardrobe down a couple sizes. So very happy with that. We talk more about that at the end of the show. I think we should probably just get right into the show. So without further ado, let's go ahead and bring on our guest. Matt Ranney, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Did I pronounce your last name right? Is that
it's good? Ranney. Yep.
Very good. Very good. So where are you speaking to us from?
I'm coming to you from Moraga, California, which is a sleepy little town outside of San Francisco.
Okay. Bay Area, basically, right?
Yep.
Cool. So I gave an overview. I'm really fascinated by Node.js now that I've had a chance to sort of do some of the research on this. I gave an overview at the beginning of the show about what Node.js is about, but why don't you give us sort of the 30,000-foot view? What problem is Node.js solving?
Sure. So it is a way that you can write server programs in JavaScript. It is that might actually be 50,000 feet or above. not a lot of oxygen in that description, but it really is like the main kind of like new interesting thing about Node is that you get to use JavaScript. Like this Google's V8 JavaScript engine is really good. It's really fast, and it's getting faster all the time. And this makes it possible to use Java. JavaScript is a language that that works really well for this. And so Node is a collection of interfaces to network and file I/O that sort of bind that to JavaScript. So it makes JavaScript a useful programming environment on the server.
So it's as opposed to probably the most familiar uses of JavaScript that we have in the industry right now, which is client-side stuff where we're doing really advanced APIs or GUIs and things like that with JavaScript. This is server-side. So
that's right.
What kinds of things would I be doing with JavaScript server-side?
So you could do anything with JavaScript server-side that you could do with, let's say, PHP or Java or any programming language. Like the difference with JavaScript is there are no I/O, like there's no I/O in the language. You know, it was sort of originally conceived in the browser, so they never made a way to open files or make, you know, real network connections. So any kind of program that you would write, be it a web server or, you know, some kind of, you know, it's the kind of things that people that it works really well for are things that need to keep a lot of network connections open, whether they're, you know, lots of incoming connections with clients or like connecting incoming clients to, you know, various backend servers, you know, of services like multiplexing access to different, you know, backends. Things that hold open a lot of network connections work really well in Node.
Now, you mentioned other programming languages like Python and Ruby and things like that. Those would typically sit underneath something like Apache or Nginx or whatever to actually connect to the internet. Is Node.js like that, or is it standalone?
It certainly can be like that. I mean, I think when in the early days of Node, that was probably the best thing to do. But I mean, these days you could replace your Nginx and your Apache with Node. You can expose Node directly to the internet. Still, you know, some people do that, and some people still put it behind a load balancer or some kind of, you know, proxy like Apache or whatever. Yeah, but I mean, it is mature enough now that you could realistically just use only Node.
How did Node come about?
Well, a while back, Ryan Dahl, who sort of founded the project, was working on some kind of, you know, independent consulting projects, and he found that he was sort of rewriting the same sort of thing again and again. And he thought, you know, there must be some way to automate this. The Google's V8 embedding API looked like an interesting thing he wanted to play with, and so he kind of put this thing together. And he was just like, I don't know, maybe this works for other people. And he presented it at JSConf, and the JavaScript community was like, whoa, this is, this changes kind of like our whole game. Now we can do JavaScript on both the client and the server. And it took off pretty quickly from there. I mean, there's a huge amount of JavaScript programming knowledge out there. You know, it's how you program a web browser. So the ability to take all of that kind of programming power, human programming power, and put it on the server, it's pretty powerful.
Cool. And you keep talking about V8. Is that a particular implementation of JavaScript?
Yeah, so that's what comes inside of your Chrome web browser. It's the JavaScript engine that Google made, but it's a separate project. It's actually open source. You can you can download it, and you can put V8 into your own programs. It's not it doesn't have to go inside of Chrome, which is interesting. The reason that it's kind of separate like this, or the kind of an interesting thing about the fact that Google made a JavaScript engine, is that there is a lot of competition for who can make the fastest JavaScript implementation. So Mozilla and Microsoft and Google are kind of duking it out, and Apple are duking it out to see who can make the fastest JavaScript. And this wins big for Node, because it means it's going to keep getting faster. And big dollars with smart VM engineers are working all the time at keeping V8 to be the fastest VM. And you know, for some things it is, and for some things it isn't. But it's really, really good.
Now I remember in the early days, whenever there would be some sort of a complex interface in JavaScript in my browser, that I was like, oh God, here we go with something slow again. How much faster are these engines now compared to, say, the early JavaScript engines?
It is almost not worth comparing them. The early JavaScript engines were, you know, kind of purely simple interpreters. The modern JavaScript engines are JIT. You know, they're applying all of the kind of best practices from the, you know, VMs that have been developed over the years. But most of this all kicked in the last, I don't know, 4 years or so. JavaScript was really slow until then, but now it's great. I mean, it's you can for many programs, you can get you know, the better performance out of JavaScript than you'll get out of any other dynamic language. I mean, certainly that is why that was what brought my company to Node in the first place. Is we were doing it in Python, and the Python VM was just way too slow, and so we tried out early versions of Node, and it was so much faster. And it's, you know, Node has gotten even faster still. It just compared, you know, all of that brain power behind the VM makes running JavaScript on, you know, in production on your server just really attractive from a performance perspective.
Is that your company looking at Node.js? Is that what brought you to Node as well?
Right. Yeah. In the early days of my company, we were trying. You know, I was always into JavaScript, and we were trying to do you know, JavaScript on a mobile, you know, a mobile app, like a phone gap style thing. And the idea of doing JavaScript on the client and the server, and, you know, sharing code and all that stuff, was very attractive. But in the end, I found that the phone gap style mobile phone interfaces are not so great compared to a purely native one. But that JavaScript actually works really, really well on the server. So we kept JavaScript on the server, and we went native with our mobile clients.
Cool. You're allowed to buzz market your company here. So you're the CTO of Voxer, and how is Voxer using Node then?
Our entire backend is written in Node. So, it is a very large distributed system that runs on, you know, over 100 machines and thousands of processes all, you know, talking to each other. You know, so lots of network connections being held open for a long time. Everything that you do with Voxer, I don't want to be, you know, that guy, like, blah, 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 listen to my company.
Don't worry about it. This is my show. You can do whatever you want. Go.
Anyway, so it's a voice messaging system. And so it's like a modern walkie-talkie. And so you can send messages to people, and they can, you know, they're live if they're listening live, or they're, you know, kind of time-shifted, saved, recorded. You can listen to them later if the person's not paying attention or not online. So anyway, we have low latency requirements, like where we need to relay this data as quickly as possible because people might be listening live. And it also means we need to keep open a lot of connections. So we have at least one connection to every mobile phone that's running our software open. And so that is, you know, many millions at any one time. And so that's, you know, this works really well in Node. And then, of course, all of the application logic and the database connectivity and, you know, the caching and just all the stuff that we do on the back end, all of that is written in Node as well.
So that means that even like the audio path, as I'm speaking to someone else over Voxer, that audio path is going through Node?
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, 100% of the communication that you do on Voxer goes through at least two Node processes, usually more like four or five.
And the UI, is there some sort of API calls that are being made over, say, something like HTTP or whatever? Is that also happening that way?
Our internal API is all HTTP, I mean, you know, HTTPS. So that's kind of the other thing that you know, Node's really good at HTTP. It's really good at, you know, progressive evented HTTP, so you can... you can sort of hook into an HTTP communication wherever you need to, you know, after the headers are parsed, you know, after, like, just, you know, at each individual data chunk in a chunked encoded request or response body. So this fine grained control you get over HTTP is really great. And so we use HTTP for everything, including live voice.
So does I want to, before we get too deep in the weeds here, I want to ask some other questions just to set the stage for people that may not be familiar with Node.js. I know I'm not, but I've been more and more interested in it because I've as I talk to companies around the Bay Area, inevitably, they're all running Node.js at this point. I mean, it seems like it's really taken off like wildfire. So I'm just wondering, for those that aren't familiar with Node.js like myself, how does it compare and contrast with languages like the typical LAMP stack, Perl, PHP, Python? What are some things that Node.js can do better, and what are some of the areas where maybe it doesn't do as well? How does the syntax compare? Things like that.
Sure. Well, so the main thing that you have to sort of consider in that kind of a comparison is those things don't all line up on the same boundaries. Linux, well, okay, I mean, you can run, like, Node runs fine on Linux, so that's cool. It also runs on Windows. I guess you can get the Apache MySQL PHP part on Windows these days, and Node matches that. I mean, you can definitely run Node on Windows. The main thing to consider, though, is that you get to, or have to, depending on your perspective, write your programs in JavaScript. That is the main thing that's different. Is JavaScript syntax. Some people like it. Some people think it's an offensive toy language that should never be used for real work. I obviously think it's a great language, but it is kind of loose and sloppy, not tight and compiled like your Javas or your C++s. It is this kind of scrappy little upstart kind of attitude, but inside when you really spend a lot of time with JavaScript, You come to realize the beauty and the elegance in this kind of simple design. Certainly I have. I've written a lot of servers in a lot of other languages, and regularly found myself in this kind of trap of like, there are so many features and so many different ways that you can do things. Like you end up just sort of, everybody you work with does it a different way, by having just a few simple, powerful features, I think it makes it a lot easier to work on programs with other people. So anyway, like what does it do, well, and what does it not do so well? Node is a pretty low level interface. Certainly out of the box, it's a very low level interface. So if you just, get Node and, start writing programs for it, you have to do a lot of work, if you want to make a web server. It has a web server built in, but it is like the lowest level web server that there is. So, you would need to get some packages that you can get from the NPM registry, which is the Node package management thing, which is by the way also a kind of a unique thing. The Node package management, I think, is really done well, better than other environments. But yeah, you out of the box, it is very, very low level, web server environment. So you'll need to either do a bunch of work yourself or explore the kind of ecosystem of different ways that you can run web servers. And so, that's a bug and a feature, but it's certainly something that is different than, say, Apache and PHP, where it's like, well, no, the web server and everything, it's all figured out for you. Plug your kind of web page with embedded logic here. It appeals, I think, Node appeals to both people that have browser programming experience and people like me who are like Unix hackers from way back, like to write programs in C and like do event loops and know what select is, and file descriptors is a meaningful concept. Like Node is a great bridge to systems programmers who like to write networks and deal with sockets, but it's kind of like a cultural bridge to the vast vast amount of browser programmers out there.
Yeah. Well, and something interesting that you just said that I kind of realized is that the whole reason I started using Lite I don't know how you pronounce it, Lighty, as it's called, instead of Apache on my Raspberry Pi, because it's lightweight, right? I don't need that other bulk that Apache has for the project that I'm doing. So I'm using Lighty. Now, I mean, it seems to me that that's an advantage here as well with Node.js, because like you say, you start with this, the bare bones minimum thing, and then just add the packages that you need, do the configuration you need for your particular application. You don't have to have all of this extra bulk that most web servers bring with them. And I think in a lot of cases, you know, that's probably an advantage to most people that are building. They want to build really lightweight, fast applications that run as quickly as possible. That's probably a good thing for them, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you'll find that the Node runtime uses very little memory. There is not even a kind of like system wide library of you know other files that you could pull in. The handful of system libraries are kind of compiled and embedded right into the executable. So there's like a single executable called Node, and you just run it and it has the sort of system library in it already, and it is very tight. I forget how much memory it uses on our machines, but if you know, starting off, I mean, it's really really lightweight compared to the alternatives, you know, web server platforms.
Just speaking, since I talked about Raspberry Pi a minute, I mean, does Node.js run well on Raspberry Pi? Do you have any? Have you played with that at all, or do you know anybody that's using Node.js on Raspberry Pi, or you know, other lightweight kind of systems like that?
Yeah, I mean, I know that people are doing some work with that. I wish I knew the accurate answer to the Raspberry Pi discussion, because I hear Node people talking about it a lot. So I can only assume that if it doesn't yet, it will soon. But yeah, I suspect that is, you know, that's a thing a lot of people want.
Yeah. Just to get back to something else you said earlier too. So if I'm familiar, you know, really my only familiarity with JavaScript is website, client side, you know, doing things with JavaScript. I mean, if I know that foundation, is there a lot more that I would need to know to get into Node.js, or is that a good foundation to start from?
Oh, it's a great foundation to start from. I mean, I think what I find the biggest difference is that you can write programs in your browser without ever learning JavaScript. That's certainly how I came to JavaScript. Was I was like, oh, whatever, JavaScript. You don't actually even have to learn that. You just view source and, you know, Google around, just find some examples and copy and paste them together. And you can sort of see what it does, and it's this dot that, and you just change your thing, and you can sort of figure out how it works without ever learning it. And if that's the kind of JavaScript programmer you are, you'll probably find that you need to learn a little bit about how JavaScript actually works to do I/O in Node. Like you need callbacks, and you end up really exercising kind of like the, you know, JavaScript's first class functions and anonymous functions and the concept of closure. This is what makes Node such a good, or you know, JavaScript such a good language for doing this evented programming. But it also is something that maybe you didn't have to learn to write browser programs. Although if you know that, of course, you're a better browser programmer. But that is one thing I find that, you know, you can get away with hacking stuff together in a browser without really learning the language.
Yeah. What about, yeah, and I totally agree with that too. But it's even true for the stuff I've done in Perl. That's how I got started, was just hacking stuff together. Someone wrote a script. I'll change these variables or change these this little input here and there, and it works. But then, of course, you want to do more stuff, and you go on from there. What about cloud? Like I said, a lot of the people that I've talked to are using Node.js, especially if they are in web or startups, trying to get things done quickly. What about cloud, though? Because it seems like a lot of people in cloud are using Node.js. Is there a good fit between cloud computing and Node.js, and what kind of solutions are there that someone could get started with if they wanted to use Node.js for a cloud solution?
Well, so yeah, I think they're kind of two answers. Like one is like Node runs everywhere, so it will run on Amazon or Rackspace or whatever. It is a program you can run on Unix, and it uses very little memory, which I think is an advantage in the cloud deployment, because usually memory is expensive, or certainly that's what you get charged for. Mm-hmm. is how much memory you use. And so getting something that, running something that doesn't use a lot of memory probably saves you money and lets you do ultra cheap cloud deployments. There is nothing that I know of in any of the Amazons or the Rackspaces that specifically addresses Node. But there is something in Joyent's offering, and that's where our operation is running. Joyent has a number of pretty powerful capabilities for running Node that are really unlike anything that I've seen in any other dynamic language. The sort of instrumentation and observability that you can get when you run Node on Joyent's platform is truly amazing. It's this kind of, dtrace, which the Linux people tend not to know much about, but like old timey Solaris people know about it, and maybe some kind of FreeBSD hackers know about it. But dtrace plus Node, there is dtrace capabilities in Node, and Joyent has put together some a nice user interface for this and some other tooling around that lets you do things like inspect the like a runtime profile without sort of stopping and starting the program. So like in production at runtime, if you experience a performance problem, you can inspect and see where this see what functions are using your CPU time without incurring any overhead when the profiling is disabled. So that's it's pretty amazing, and it works all the way into the JavaScript stack. So if your process is using a lot of CPU and you want to know why, start this profiling and see literally the JavaScript function that is getting called the most and where the process time is being spent, like in the JavaScript stack. So that's pretty powerful. And also in terms of finding memory leaks, they've got some tooling around that lets you basically take a core dump at runtime and then, sort of bring the core dump aside and do analysis on the JavaScript heap. So you can find, you can do heap analysis and figure out like, well, how much, where is all your memory going? And you can do all this without taking the process down. So it's really great for, production operations.
Yeah. Yeah, I just realized as you were talking that I'm an old-timey person now because I know what dtrace is. But, I used to work at Sun, and I used to work with a lot of the guys that actually wrote dtrace. So, and a lot of them are at Joyent now. So I guess I'm special in that way. But I can see where dtrace would really come in. I mean, is there a relationship with Node.js and Joyent? What is there? Are people there working on Node.js? I mean, you said that I find it surprising that Node.js has some dtrace capabilities built in above, and it sounds like above and beyond what you would normally be able to get out of dtrace. So, is there a relationship there, and what is that all about?
Yeah. So Joyent is sort of the corporate sponsor, if you like, or steward, I guess, is I think what they like to call it. They employed Ryan Dahl when he was leading the project, and they employ Isaac Schluter now that he's leading the project. And Joyent uses Node internally for a bunch of their development, but they are they're making a bet on Node for their cloud deployment and their cloud offering. And so they do a lot of work on it, and it's an open source project, but they contribute heavily to it, and they've built more tooling, more advanced tooling than I think most people realize is even possible for a dynamic language like Node that uses a JIT VM. The relationship with Joyent is definitely deep. It's not casual. They are invested big time in it.
You said earlier, I think you actually just alluded to it, that basically that Node.js, part of what gives it advantage and speed is that it's a single process, but essentially event driven. Now, for most people who are doing web development on the back end, they're using parallel processes, so they don't have to worry about whether what they're about to do is blocking or not. Can you describe the differences between being able to block and having to do it event-driven for people who aren't familiar with that?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, if you take the classic case of like a PHP, you know, a PHP running in sort of the classic, you know, Apache configuration where every incoming request goes to its own PHP process. When that PHP process goes to do I/O, like it goes to ask the database for something or read a file off disk or whatever, that entire process is sitting there waiting. That PHP runtime cannot service any more incoming requests. The whole runtime sits there and it waits for that, you know, network thing to return or that disk thing to return. That is blocking and it can't do anything else, which is why you need to have, you know, lots of these running at the same time. And this is, you know, why it uses a lot of memory and, you know, lots of, you know, a big tuning exercise you have to go through to sort of, you know, get this all working properly. The difference in Node is nothing blocks. So nothing blocks on I/O, I should say. So when you go to the database, you return immediately to the event loop. And when the database is ready, it will call you back. So a single process can service all kinds of things. It will multiplex access in and out of the network or, you know, in and out of the sort of I/O domain. The place where it doesn't multiplex is if you're in CPU. So if you're actually, you know, the big troll is, what if I want to compute Fibonacci in my web server? And like, well, I don't know, like that makes it go slow. Like if you do a lot of CPU work, there is a single thread and that is where all the work is being done. And if you block it by doing CPU work, other things will have to wait until that's done. And so if you're on a machine that has multiple CPUs, that is not the best way to set things up. So of course, the way to fix this is you need to get multiple processes. So Node has a cluster module. You can spawn child processes and there, you know, the cluster module is a way that you can kind of get, you know, multiple kind of copies of yourself working on the same thing. So there are techniques to take advantage of multiple processors. What we found for our application is CPU is the last thing that we're out of. Like what we run out of is we run out of memory because we're trying to, you know, keep a lot of state for a lot of different users and a lot of different things. And that's it. and then we have bugs. The actual running out of CPU is just not something certainly that we found in our application. But if you do run out of CPU, you're going to need to get another process.
Well, now, does that mean – I saw the documentation on Cluster just before the show here, so I probably don't know much about it. But is there – so if you had, say, a some sort of web request coming in and each one of them had to do, say, a short blocking item, could you – say you have a 32-core machine. Could you fire off 31 other processes that would sort of sit as a pool and handle that actually CPU thing, and then in that callback, be able to get back to the original web request?
So, yeah, kind of. I mean, the way Cluster works is it allows multiple processes to sort of share who accepts an incoming request, and so then if you know all of those processes have some, you know, CPU blocking work to do, then they'll all, you know. So someone else will take the next incoming request. So it's a way to sort of farm out on the incoming side the work to different runtimes, and then all of your state will be right there.
Yeah. Okay. And that's the other thing I sort of noticed that was interesting about having only a single process is that a lot of times in say a PHP application or in my case Perl applications, you had to do session management because the next hit that comes in is coming into a different process. But it looks like with Node, I can just simply have a global object of some kind and say, here's the state information about this particular transaction going on. And it's always coming into the same process, so I can always process that. Is that accurate?
Well, for the same connection, it will. I think what a lot of people do for this, you know, for that kind of thing, is they'll keep their session state in something like Redis or Memcache, and that's, you know, that's why we, you know, I wrote the Redis library for Node, is sharing state, like sharing global state across processes, works really well when you can put it in an in-memory database like Redis. But you know, the interesting thing about cluster is, I kind of think most people don't actually need it. Like, I think people think they need it because they come from history with PHP, and they think, oh yeah, like I need to have, like, I'm doing all these blocking operations, but since none of the IO is blocking, you get a massive simplification win by having it all like having Node take care of this IO multiplexing, and then just writing us one single process that runs all the logic. Like, I find most of the time that works just fine, and cluster is really only needed in rare cases.
Okay. So the thing that I also saw in the async calls is it reminded me a lot of the AJAX calls that, you know, in a client side thing, you can't, you know, you can say, go get this web page, but everybody seems to want to then, you know, have the web page right there in the next step. But that isn't the way it works, because it has to happen asynchronously while the browser is still operating other things. So is it fair to say that event-driven programming in Node is similar to making AJAX calls?
It is very, very similar. So if you've done a lot of AJAX in the browser, Node will feel right at home, because you don't, like, you know, some things are asynchronous. They you need to supply a callback. With JavaScript, you get a really nice syntax for constructing callbacks kind of like in line. So you can sort of see a linear flow of how the program works. But it is the same mental model of, you know, if you want to do this, and then once you get the response from that operation, you can act on it. That those things happen asynchronously, both in the browser and in Node.
And one of the things that leads to, unfortunately, I think, and maybe there's no way around this, is the notion of making the first call, having the callback then have to make a second asynchronous call, and having the third step be in the callback for the second one. So you end up with this really, really heavily nested thing. Is there any way to turn that inside out so you can have a better abstraction?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there are a number of libraries that people put together, you know, these sort of flow control libraries that try to make that simpler. We've kind of, you know, we sort of fixed this by convention. I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, our solution is kind of like nitty gritty JavaScript programming details, but I mean, we leverage the prototype chain to sort of group logical operations. We make a prototype for each logical operation, and all of the callbacks are on that, and it gives it a more natural flow. I think it's safe to say that you should probably just feel the pain first. Like just nest it up, just make a bunch of nested callbacks. And if it gets too painful, then, you know, start exploring some like these flow control libraries or restructuring things. But it's not that bad. You know, most programs, like, you know, you get a few layers of nesting, and then it's still pretty readable. But I wouldn't suggest starting with some higher level abstraction, because you don't know what you're trading away.
I think it's funny. I mean, listening back and forth to Randall and you talk, it's it kind of strikes me as funny. It's like dating. You know, I'm having a blind date here with Node.js, and like Randall's already on third base. You know, he's way down.
Hey.
He's like, well, what about this process? What about this call? It just strikes me as funny. So let's bring it up a level just for a second, and then I'm sure we'll have a few more technical questions to get to as well. But I'm kind of curious, who's using Node.js? Like, who are the big names that you might throw out? Is people like, oh, I've never heard of Node.js, and you say, oh yeah, well, these companies are using it. What kind of names would you throw out there?
Sure. So Wayne, of course, you know, this very great company called Voxer is using it. you know, there are other big names. I mean, so Yahoo recently announced that they're doing a bunch of stuff in Node. I mean, they'd sort of you know, announce it a while ago, but they wouldn't ever tell anybody what they're doing. But, you know, now they can sort of publicly say that they're doing it. LinkedIn is using it. Walmart is using it. There are, I think, as one of you said earlier, lots of people are using it, but, you know, it seems like everybody you talk to says, oh, yeah, I'm using it. But not a lot of people are sort of talking about it publicly that, you know, sort of, yes, we're using this in production here. I think everybody's really excited about it. And there are a lot of projects underway. And we haven't yet seen kind of all of the announcements. Like they haven't all been, you know, released or you know, talked about publicly. But I think you're going to see a whole lot more big names start announcing, you know, stuff soon as these projects mature.
What about certain projects that you've seen people using Node.js for? There was one that came up even in the IRC this morning about something called Node Copter, which is a programmable quadcopter, I guess, or drone capability. I haven't looked into it too much, but it looks really interesting. So what are some of the more interesting things that you've seen people do with Node.js?
Well, so there's kind of a like an experimental sort of like, you know, hacker culture around Node of just like, you know, the hack days and like oh, how hard can it be? Let's just make this work. This is kind of part of the, you know, especially from like the browser heritage, like, you know, you can just kind of make something work like really easily and quickly, and it's fun. So that's, you know, kind of where the Node culture is rooted, and it you know, as now that Node is getting a little more mature and people are using it for real work, and it's, you know, and it really works. Like, you know, most of the bugs have been, you know, eradicated. So now people are starting to do like crazy stuff with it, like, you know, control these quadcopters and whatever. You know, we did a hardware hack day at Voxer a while back. You know, people made all kinds of crazy stuff sort of controlled by Node. I mean, definitely the controlling those AR drones is the most interesting sort of non like web server application of Node that I've ever heard of.
Yeah. Well, it's always fun to have those, to be at those kinds of events or see what happens, what the outcome is of those events. You know, like with Perl, it's like, well, who can write the shortest one line code to run a Tetris game or something? And so it's a little bit of a challenge, which is always kind of fun. There was a question from the chat room I want to get to before we get too far here, which is, are many Node.js users writing in CoffeeScript or some other compile to JS language? Is that something that people do?
Yeah, for sure, and it works just fine. There is a little, I would say, friction in the Node community about what's the appropriate use of CoffeeScript. I mean, people who love CoffeeScript really love it, and they think it's super great, and they can't imagine why anyone would not want to write their programs that way. And the tricky problem is when they want to get collaboration from others, not everybody thinks that CoffeeScript is the greatest thing since JavaScript. And certainly there are issues with debugging compiled to JS languages. And so a number of projects like start out, you know, people write things in CoffeeScript and then they publish them, and then they find like, it's hard to get, you know, collaboration with other people on this CoffeeScript thing. But definitely lots of people do it, and it works just fine in Node.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about, I thought there was one other question here, maybe not. What about, there is. So could this be used for home automation? That's another question. It kind of goes along with a lot of the things that I work on. Like I mentioned Raspberry Pi earlier. Is this something that could be used for home automation as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the event-driven nature of Node sort of makes it a natural fit. It's like that is what you do, is you just wait for I/O and then you do things when I/O happens. And so, you know, you can multiplex access to many, many different devices and wait for them to tell you something. I don't know of people who are, you know, doing this like for serious, for real home automation with it, but you know, there is an Arduino library, and it seems like if someone hasn't done that they will soon.
Very cool. So, hey, there we go. Hey, I distracted John at the same time that I was starting to talk. That's no good. Hey, how is the community organized, and who decides what features are going in? And I know you said there's a strong relationship with Joint sort of being the corporate sponsor of this. How much control do they have over it?
Well, so the first thing, the community has a lot of a lot of contributors. You can look on the GitHub page and the contributors list is numerous. There is a core team. I forget how many people are on this these days. It's like six or something like that, maybe eight, I forget. There's one person who sort of has ultimate, executive control, which is Isaac Schluter, and but other people have commit access, and, Isaac is a Joint employee. So in order to contribute to Node, you have to sign this contributor, this licensing agreement. I'm pretty sure the license is still like one of the good ones, like MIT or something like that. But mm-hmm. you have to assign, like Joint owns the name Node, basically. So if somebody forked Node, they couldn't call it Node. They could take the code and call it something else. Sort of corporate backed projects are like this. You have to call it something else, but you can use the code. So, there's a big community but there's a core team that sort of who they're, if not their full time, their most of their time goes into working on just Node.
We have a question from the chat room from Key. I like to say the names of the people because that way they can feel special. Is there a decent testing framework for doing TDD with Node?
Sure. There are many, and it is a hotly debated topic about like which test framework to use. The one that we use is Mocha, but there are lots and lots, and you should just check them out because there are many different things to explore in the test framework department.
And I noticed that version number is still zero something, except it sounds like you've built an entire business around this already. So would you say it's production ready? And if so, why the zero version number?
Yeah, the zero, it's funny. Like I think Google sort of made this kind of version deflation by calling everything beta. Like, remember how everything was beta? Like Gmail was beta for like, after they had 10 million users and they're like, it's still beta. It's this kind of like self-deprecating little thing. I think that's this sort of, caught on. But it's production ready. Like we use it in production. We have a large production deployment. So do many other people. I think the zero, starting with a zero versus starting with a one, it does mean something, but it doesn't mean what it used to mean. Like it doesn't like 10 years ago, like you would sort of think like, ooh, it starts with a zero. Maybe we shouldn't use that. And these days I think it's, I don't know. What 1.0 I think will, Isaac has some idea of what 1.0 will really mean, but I don't think you shouldn't let zero stop you from using it, I guess is the conclusion. Like just it's ready. It does real work for you right now.
So what you're saying is zero is the new one.
I think it's kind of like, it's an attempt to like not even have that discussion. Like you shouldn't worry about like whether something's done. Like it's never done. Like we're always going to keep working on it. We're always going to keep making it better. There will always be bugs, and it's kind of a fluid thing. And the version numbers are more just like a checkpoint so we can talk about the same thing. And you can have an ever increasing number so that you can compare, like, and tell whether something is newer or older. But it is just sort of meaningless in terms of doneness.
You know, I keep saying that about Pearl 6 too, but people don't believe me anymore. So yeah, Pearl 6 is a workable version of Rokudo right now, and it gets a new release every month. But it's just that, you know, will it ever be done? Not really. It's just going to be better over time. And it sounds like Node's in the same sort of general roadmap. We're just about out of time. Is there anything I haven't covered that you want to make sure our audience is aware of?
No, I mean, I think we talked about a lot of good stuff. I mean, I think you'll find that Node is like, I mean, Node is a fun thing to work with. Like, if you haven't tried it, like, you should at least just write some programs in it and just see what it's like, because it's really fun. Like, it's not like all serious. Like, and you know, like, you writing server programs in Java, like, you gotta do all this, like, this extra work and all this boilerplatey stuff, and you're editing XML files and there are just like a million moving parts all over the place, and it's this big heavyweight operation. And in Node, it's like, you just get out your editor and you just write a thing, and you're like, it's a very different experience of writing programs. And if you haven't tried it, I highly recommend it. It's a good time.
And I did like that just by typing Node, I already had a REPL, so I was able to start typing things at it, and I was invoking os.this and parens and seeing what the values were for that. That was kind of nice.
We got pretty colors in there and read line like functionality. You can even that's one of my favorite features, which almost no one knows about. It apparently is. You can connect to the REPL over TCP, so you can start a REPL server. And then you can sort of get that same functionality like later, like to your running processes. And so we use this all the time. Like, our server is running, and you know, you want to check something out, you want to inspect something, or even, you know, change some of the state. You can open up a REPL on a running process and, you know, poke at it, like run JavaScript, you know, change it, inspect it, etc. It's pretty powerful.
Can you have it reload modules?
Reloading modules. I mean, no. But the complicated answer is, of course, you can do whatever you want. I mean, you yeah. absolutely can load a new module and then kind of swap it in place of the old one. And the old one, you know, the cleanup is a little dicey. But one day, don't try to do that. But like, you can definitely swap out, you know, change variables. And I've even replaced functions, you know, just with a new one, just to see if that fixed a bug on just one process, you know, just like, I wonder if this is what's going on. You can definitely change your program at runtime.
Very good. And where do people go to find out more about Node?
Node.js.org is right there on the screen. That is where you go.
Very good. All right. Hey, so, I have to ask my two standard questions. If you've seen the show before, you know that I'm doing this in every show. So your favorite scripting language would be?
Favorite scripting language. Boy, I mean, that implies that there's a difference between scripting and programming. Ha, ha, ha.
Oh, don't go there. Don't go. But yes, the answers are generally scripting languages.
Programmer since the dawn of Perl 4. So I'm definitely got to go with Perl.
Yay! One for me, finally. And your favorite text editor?
At the moment, I use TextMate.
Ah, so, yes. Not a bad one at all. Actually, it has some Emacs functionality built into it, so it's really nice. Very cool. Well, it's been really great having you on. A lot of people have been anticipating the show for quite a while, and so I'm glad we finally got you on the show, and thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Very good. That was Matt Ranney, who is representing the Node.js project. Very informative. Really lots of interesting answers there from there. What did you think, Aaron?
Well, now it's complicated my life immensely, right? Because I've written, it's like every show, right? I mean, I've written this thing on the Raspberry Pi in Perl, and I'm thinking, I really want to kind of see how I would do this in Python. So maybe I'll do that next. And now I'm thinking, maybe I should see if I could do this in Node. So mm-hmm. it's like, it's just, it's no free time for me anymore. It's all like, I have to follow up on this stuff. So I'm at least going to go in and follow up and see, you know, has anyone written a media player in Node? How difficult would that be to implement on Raspberry Pi? You know, things like that, that I'm working on for my project. So it's very, very interesting. It's something that, like I said, I've heard a lot about talking to customers and talking to people at conferences. You know, what are you working on? You know, and then the question comes up, can I do this in Node? You know, and it's like, I got to follow up on this. So certainly seems like it's something that's changing, perhaps the way people implement typical things on the back end. Of course, JavaScript's been around on the front end for a very long time, but now it seems like maybe people ought to go take a look and see if it would work for them on the back end as well.
Well, you know, one of the things, when I discovered Poe, which is a non-blocking, event-driven server in Perl that basically takes one process and you can, and it has all these async callouts and things like that. So we could do essentially really high-performance web servers all written in Perl. Mm-hmm. It changed the way that I started thinking about the kinds of daemons that I write, because I could do complex things. And Poe has a zillion plugins as well. You know, go do file.io, go do database access, go get a web page. And so you could essentially write, for example, a web crawler that would just operate lickety-split, but all in one process, because all the asynchronous calls to go get the individual pages you're crawling, when they finally came back, you could then do the processing and use that to travel to the next thing. So I'm familiar with event-driven programming from that, and a little bit with Ajax, which is why I asked the question about that. But so it looks like this is the same sort of solution for people who don't want to learn Perl. I don't mind that people don't want to learn Perl. It's fine. Although, if you do want to learn Perl, I could recommend two really good books. And they're both with my name on them. So, but this sounds great, and it sounds like for people who are used to JavaScript event programming on the front end, which more and more people are, because we're doing all these wonderful, you know, Ajax GUIs and things like that, and they want to move this to the back end. But of course, it's more than just web stuff. It's, you know, it's file.io, it's database access, it's raw TCP connections, so you can do whatever you want over those. Like even that REPL on a telnet connection, that's pretty interesting there. So I'm excited by it. Now, Aaron, unlike you, since I'm on almost every show, I get way more projects that I want to play with than I have time for. You're at least lucky that you only come in about every 4 weeks or so, so you don't get the whole shebang. You don't get to have too many things that are distracting, although you probably might watch the rest of the shows. I presume you're also an audience member of our show. So
yeah, I've got enough going on, you know, on the other weeks. Enough stuff comes up. It's like I feel like I'm just overwhelmed with stuff I want to do. I guess that's the downside of living in a socially aware environment that we do. So.
Yeah. Well, just before this show, a coworker of mine showed me this humorous YouTube posting about Node.js. And I have to warn you, there's a slight bit of coarse language. We may stop the video midway through if we have to do that. But if you can't handle coarse language, please fast forward about 5 minutes right now. But John, you want to go ahead and pull that up?
And in conclusion, we have found Apache to be an excellent server for our web applications. Any questions?
Yes, I have a question. Why didn't you use Node.js? Node.js is an event-driven, non-blocking I/O server that can be used to build high-performance web applications.
That is an excellent question. We evaluated several alternative web servers and concluded that, while options like Node.js are very interesting, Apache meets our needs and has a solid track record.
But it doesn't have performance. Everybody knows that Apache applications are slow because they use blocking I/O and have context switches.
That's a commonly held belief, that threaded web servers are somehow less performant or scalable than event-based servers. In fact, if you measure carefully, you'll find that both models have similar performance characteristics.
Threads don't scale, simple as that.
That may have been true 10 years ago. It's not true today.
Node.js will run circles around Apache because Apache was built before async was discovered.
This is where I typically stab myself repeatedly in the ears with a fork until I stop hearing you. I've looked at Node. It uses a single-threaded loop that dispatches events to handlers. It's a proven model that solves some concurrency problems, but at the cost of code complexity.
It gives techies like me the control to wring every last CPU cycle out of our servers.
It must feel empowering to be totally responsible for the performance of your application. To be always on the lookout for blocking operations that should be split into little pieces, each perfectly tailored to optimize concurrent throughput. All the complexities of assembler with the efficiencies of JavaScript.
I'm a total speed junkie.
Do you know what this reminds me of?
The invention of the transistor.
It reminds me of the invention of threads. Threading libraries do exactly what you're doing manually. They break up pieces of code to be executed intermittently, switching from instructions that are waiting on I/O to instructions that are ready to run. But your sequential code stays intact. You may recall sequential code. That's the code you can read.
But it's slow as a dog.
Your async program is like something from a 19th century gothic horror story. Drunk with your own sense of power, you reassemble pieces of code that were once coherent, stitching them together with event loops and callback functions until your monster, grotesque and menacing, is ready to be brought to life in a JavaScript VM. You throw the switch and the hideous creature awakes, rises, and lurches forward. You're simultaneously elated and terrified that something so unnatural could work at all. When you realize what you've unleashed, the pure immorality of it, your creation reaches out with its bloody mangled arms and strangles you.
But it's fast as hell.
If you're willing to suffer complex code for performance, why not write an Nginx module and see?
Node.js is the most badass rockstar tech to come out since Ruby on Rails.
As much as I want to be an optimist and look forward to human progress, people like you stop me dead in my tracks. You're a fanatic in the Church of Technology fashion. I could present you with fact after fact after fact that your thinking about asynchronous programming is completely wrong. But why bother when you equate technology to rock bands, fancy yourself a software hipster by wearing your Node t-shirt, and celebrate horrible code? Maybe you are cool. Hell, maybe you have groupies. But when it comes to knowing what the f*** you're talking about, you have all the facilities of a parrot that says, non-blocking, over and over again.
Non-blocking is the secret in the async sauce. With it, you go fast. Without it, you go slow.
Do you know when humans discovered that the world is round?
1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
It was 240 BC, by a Greek mathematician named Eratosthenes. He conducted a simple experiment using the length of shadows and the distance between cities to not only prove the Earth is round, but also calculate its circumference.
Sounds low-tech.
It was utterly brilliant. But somehow, for 1.5 millennia, it was common knowledge that the world was flat. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of raft ignorance. How in mother hell does this happen? It was you. You. Who make claims about thread performance without measuring. You, who claim hacking your code with a machete, turning it inside out into a twisted unrecognizable mess, will somehow make it go faster. You, who spend your time alternating between problems that are already solved, and problems that don't actually exist. You are the reason science was set back 1,000 years. The reason we have not cured cancer. The reason we have not solved world hunger. It's because of you, mother, that we were not all using Lisp.
I'm sorry, what was that last part again?
Never mind.
Did you just say Lisp?
You misheard me.
I could have sworn you just said Lisp.
If there are no other questions, this concludes my presentation.
Did you just say Lisp? That's funny.
Non-blocking is the secret in the async sauce.
Yeah.
With all respect to Matt Ranney, our guest, I had to play like the other side of that argument just to play that out. So anyway, all good there. All good. That's it on that. Unless you have anything else on today's show there, Aaron, I want to go ahead and do the upcoming guests.
Yeah, go for it.
All right, there we go. So we've got G-Event coming up next week. That's a fast Python event loop based on libEvent. We're going to compare that with Twisted a little bit because they both cover the same space. We've got Concrete CMS, which is a content management system for marketing, but that's made for marketing but built for geeks. What a nice model. We'll see what that means about. Alphonic, which is an automatic audio post-production web service for broadcasters and podcasters. A little bit different from a normal show. It's not actually open source per se, except it uses a lot of open source components, and we want to see how a business is built around using open source and why that's an advantage for them. Tapper, which is a test infrastructure originally developed at AMD and now available for everybody. Media Goblin, which is similar to basically build your own YouTube, build your own Flickr, build your own media production server. Zotonic, which is an Erlang-based web framework and content management system. CakePHP, which is the web framework with both the Zotonic and... No, wait. CakePHP and Poodle, the next show after that, were both rescheduled for from Q4 last year because we had some cancellations. And a show that I'm really looking forward to is the Dart language. That's being developed at Google as being something that runs natively in Chrome, but also can compile down to straight JavaScript, but has a lot more high-level programming features. So this is really getting a lot of traction, and we're looking forward to the interview really well. And then rounding up Q1, we got Pinto, which is a localized CPAN. So basically, you can have a comprehensive Perl archive network that's just local for your company and put local modules in there and have one common build and things like that. So you can find out about all these guests and more, the ones we're also looking at to get on Q2 when we start opening that up, by going to our spreadsheet, which is linked from twit.tv/floss. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus. I post all the upcoming guests and bookings there. Also at Floss Weekly on Twitter and Identica. We took quite a few questions from the chat room today, and that's at live.twit.tv during our tapings, which are generally 8:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. You can follow me personally at Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter and Identica. But more often, I'm mostly just posting stuff to Google Plus. So that's Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus. If you notice, I'm still a little bit thinner. Again, I'm down 31 pounds since I started about 4 months ago. I'm holding stable, which is sort of amazing to do during the holidays because there's all these other activities that you do and you get off plan a little bit. I did get off plan. I went up a few pounds, but I'm back down to 180 again. I'm probably only going to lose about another 10 pounds. I'm thinking I'm very cool. I'm getting compliments on what I look like. It's not a full body camera here, but if you saw the difference just in the pictures I've been posting to Facebook and stuff, you actually can figure that out. I think that's all I've got for me. Aaron, what do you want to talk about?
I've also started a low carb, high fat diet. So, mm-hmm. I just started that at the new year. Just started a few days ago. I've already lost a couple pounds, but that typically mm-hmm. happens. I'm not too excited yet because that typically happens at the beginning anyway. But other than that, you can follow me at the best place to follow me is on Google Plus because that's where I actually get to interact with people, maybe do a hangout about something or talk about something. If you want to talk directly to me or have a chat with me, that's the best place to go. And I am at Aaron Newcomb on Google Plus, as well as other all the other social networks, the important ones anyway, Facebook, Twitter, and MySpace, Friendster, at Aaron Newcomb if you're into those networks as well. So follow me there.
Wait, Friendster? You still have an active Friendster?
I still have a Friendster account. Sure. I mean, it never canceled. I probably should. Eventually, all that information is going to get hacked out to somebody. So,
actually, it was funny because I got a notification there about 9 months ago that said that some term of service was updating. I went, my account's still active? And same thing from MySpace. I got a MySpace update like 6 months ago or maybe a year ago now. But it was like, my God, my MySpace is still active too? That's just really, oh man, we're old.
Yeah,
we're
it's awful. Well, it's awful because, this is one of the downsides. I mean, you sign up for everything and then you never go back and cancel it. Right. And so you're exposed all over the place without remembering, oh, I should really go back and cancel this or not. I don't use it anymore, whatever. I know I'm really lazy about that. I should go back and clean that stuff up more often.
Well, Aaron, thanks for coming into the studio and being the co-host for this week. Actually, you were coming to the studio anyway, weren't you?
Yeah, I'll be on Twig later today, I brought a little project in with me that I want to talk about if Leo lets me. It's not really related to Google or cloud, but it's just something I've been working on, and I mentioned it in the last show, the last Twig I was on, so I thought I'd bring it back and show off the nearly finished project. It's never actually finished, but it's production ready. So
it's zero dot something still, huh?
Yeah, it's the radio here, which actually it works now thanks to Raspberry Pi. It actually, you turn it on and it plays old time radio. So
awesome.
Yeah. It's not even, it's funny because I left all the guts in there because they look really cool, all the tubes and stuff.
Yep.
But I don't need it at all. I could just take it all out and it would still work. So
great. Well, happy new year to everyone. This being our first show of the year, and we'll see you all again next time on Floss Weekly.